MacCast, Sunday, November 22nd, 2015. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we've got a pretty feature-filled episode for you today, mostly surrounding a lot of information regarding Apple's latest products, specifically the iPad Pro, but I think we've got a little Apple TV thrown in there. We're going to look at the Apple Pencil and what's going on with that. I know they're still hard to come by, but they're slowly trickling out, and there's some news there. As a matter of fact, I was able to get my hands on one. So one thing we're going to do in this episode is I'm going to give you my thoughts and opinions on that. We're going to talk about Apple's little oops that happened last week. Maybe you got an error message that was a little bit concerning. We'll let you know what that is and whether or not you have to worry about it. And also some updated stats on where iPhone and Apple Watch sales are. We've got all that in the news. And then also your feedback. I've got a couple responses and comments on Apple cables. We talked about those in a prior episode and some of the issues that some of us have with them. We're also going to give you some tips and tricks related to the new Apple TV, specifically the remote, and then also dive into cleaning out and gaining some more space, both in OS X and in iOS. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile Software. Specifically today, I want to talk to you about Text Expander. This is actually an app that I need to have on every Mac and iOS device. And I literally mean that. I've been using these, using Text Expander for so long that it is just one of the first things that I install after doing install of my operating system. It's like operating system, and then it can vary, but it's Text Expander, Dropbox, and 1Password. Those all go on there right immediately. And the reason is for Text Expander is it lets you create snippets of text that you can expand in any application. What does that mean? Well, basically it means that you can type just a little bit and actually write a lot. And it's meant for those things where you find yourself typing the same thing over and over again, or even variations of the same thing, because it can handle some variables and fill-in fields and things like that. So anything that you find yourself typing over and over again can be made into a snippet. So that could be your favorite recipe that everybody asks you to keep emailing them. That happens a lot around the holidays, all right? We're going into the holidays. Hey, do you have that great cookie recipe? Throw that into a snippet, and then you can answer those emails really quickly. Or maybe it's directions to your house for your holiday party. How to do a clean install of OS X. Okay, that one's mine. I have that one in there. But you get the point. A lot of people will ask me, how do I clean install the operating system? I have a snippet for that. I can quickly respond to those emails, and it saves me time. And now Text Expander will even recommend stuff to you as it sees you typing the same thing over and over again. So it pops up recommendations, says, hey, do you want to turn this into a snippet? And makes that whole process really, really easy. And as I mentioned earlier, your replies and your snippets can even be dynamic with optional text, fill-in forms for variable data. So, you know, if it is that recipe thing, you can create a field to, at expansion time, right when you activate the snippet, plug in a name, say, in the salutation, right? So, dear Joe or dear Adam, it'll pop up and you can fill that in right as you're expanding the snippet. And great thing about Text Expander, if you have the iOS version as well, Text Expander Touch, you can sync all of your data through iCloud or Dropbox. So you can have the same snippets on iOS as you do on the macOS desktop. And if you're wondering, how does that work with any app on iOS? Well, Text Expander Touch has a custom keyboard. So you can use the custom keyboard and get direct access to all of your snippets, even on iOS. Great stuff. I'd really like you to check it out. All you have to do is visit smilesoftware.com/MacCast. You can even download a free demo of Text Expander to try it out right from that URL, smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. Let's kick things off with a little more information about the iPad Pro. It's been out for a little over a week now. As you know, I've talked about it on this episode. If you didn't catch the last episode, Amigos episode with Victor Cajiao and Ken Ray, we talked about it a little bit. I am so far really enjoying the iPad Pro. Not sure on the size yet. It's big. And I'm going to try and have it be, and I think you've heard this if you've heard prior episodes as well, I'm going to try and have it be a mobile replacement for my MacBook Pro. It's going to be a little bit challenging, and I'll bring you along for the ride. Well, you'll hear about that on future episodes of the MacCast, but so far, I really like it. I'm hoping to get Apple's accessories, which still haven't shipped to me yet, specifically the smart keyboard, but it's on its way. It's been ordered, so hopefully it'll be here in the next week or so, and we'll be able to talk about that a little more. But reviewers have gotten their hands on things. They've been doing some testing. They've been tearing them down. They've been putting them through benchmarks, and the news is looking pretty good. The iPad Pro is a pretty powerful machine, at least according to some of the data gathered by Ars Technica. They said the iPad Pro has that A9X processor, that's something we knew, is a dual-core chip running at about 2.25 gigahertz. And that means it was able to get Geekbench scores of 3,233 in single-core tests and 5,498 in multi-core tests of browser-based stuff. So those were browser-based CPU tests. And that means that it beats out the iPad Air 2 and, even more surprisingly, the 12-inch Mac or Retina MacBook in that same test. And it gets even better when they started running it through its graphics test. The iPad Pro really shines on graphics tests, specifically in the GFX Bench OpenGL tests. It was able to beat out the 2015 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro with the integrated Intel Iris 5200 graphics. So not the dedicated, discrete graphics, but the built-in Intel graphics. Yeah, it came out faster than that in those graphics tests. It also bested the 12-inch MacBook, the 2015 MacBook Air, the 2015 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, and Microsoft's Surface Pro, along with all of the recent iPads. Not surprising that it beat out all the recent iPads. The iPad Pro certainly is the monster, the pro of the iPads. But I think we can just safely say it screams at a lot of tasks. And that immediately led to people speculating this could actually open the way for something we've been speculating on and talking about for a while, that Apple could possibly release a Siri Max sometime in the future. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to run OS X. Don't expect a converged operating system. That started, getting thrown around this week too. And Tim Cook was actually specifically asked about it in an interview. And he said, quote, "We feel strongly that customers are not really looking for a converged Mac and iPad. So they're sticking to that line. They're not going to merge things at any point." And, I still think they look at how we use tablets and how we use desktops as completely different experiences. And I totally agree with that philosophy. They are very different things. My little experiment so far, just a week and a half into it with the MacBook Pro has only solidified that in my mind a little bit. I don't really think I want them converged. Actually, one of the things I'm struggling with using the iPad Pro as a mobile desktop replacement, or a notebook replacement rather, is that I have the keyboard. I'm using the Logitech one because, again, I don't have my Apple one yet. And it really turns it into almost a MacBook Pro-like experience. The problem is that makes it almost like a touchscreen laptop. And if you've listened to the show for a couple years, you know that I've never thought that that would work out very well. Always having to move from the plane of sort of typing on the keyboard to touching the screen, I felt was not going to be an ideal experience. And that's been so far my experience with using the iPad Pro with a keyboard. Now, if you move that to the on-screen keyboard where you're sticking in one plane and you're always touching the same surface, that seems to work a lot better. So what's interesting so far in this experiment is my initial thought was I was really going to want a keyboard to be able to use with the iPad Pro. But because of its size, the on-screen keyboard, especially in landscape mode, is almost like a full desktop keyboard. And I think the experience is better because you're still typing and swiping and working on one surface. Using the keyboard is convenient, but the keyboard shortcuts work, kind of. You can't really navigate around, and I don't know that you actually should. And I think we talked about this a little bit on the Mac Roundtable podcast. I was on the Mac Roundtable podcast this week, and you can go take a listen to that on iTunes and hear my thoughts. I was on with Victor Cahiao and Allison Sheridan. But it was just sort of this interesting thing, and I think it just further solidifies the statement that, you know, Apple is making, that we really shouldn't converge these things. But getting back to the processor, it is looking like Apple's A-series processor could make a really great mobile processor, and I don't think there's anything limiting it from running a full version of OS X. So it may just be a matter of time, especially maybe in the MacBook line, where we see Apple move from Intel to their own chip designs and their own processors. It could be happening. We don't have any evidence that it is, but it would not be surprising, I think, at this point, especially based on some of these benchmark tests that have been done with the processor in the iPad Pro. I think we've discussed a little bit, too, this idea of developing camps of users. And I really think this goes into this idea where Apple doesn't really have to converge desktop and mobile. I think Apple is going to target those camps and different camps. And what those camps are is, I think you have iOS users who only use iPhones and iPads as their primary computing platform or their only computing platform. And I do think moving forward, that may end up being Apple's largest market of consumers. Then I think you're going to have Mac users who have Mac desktops and Mac laptops. So for desktop and mobile, they're using Mac systems. They only work in OS X and with OS X applications. And I really see that as mostly what you would call quote unquote pro users, you know, video users, photography users, designers, programmers. There's going to be, you know, areas outside this, but I think that's going to be kind of the core users. And I think, you know, some of these users are going to be hybrids, which is the third classification. But I think you're going to have, hey, I want really a really powerful desktop mobile experience, and I'm going to use a MacBook Pro, Retina MacBook Pro, and I'm going to have an iMac on my desktop or a Mac Pro on my desktop. And then that last category is the one I may end up ultimately falling into and the one that I kind of want to fall into, and that is a hybrid user where you have a Mac on your desk and that's kind of your pro computing platform or your main computing platform, and then your iOS on the go. And when you're mobile, you're using iOS and you're moving back and forth in between using a lot of cloud services like iCloud or Dropbox to move your documents and things back and forth. But I really think the biggest group or camp Apple sees moving forward is really those people using iPhones and iPads. But I don't think that's going to be at the expense of replacing the desktop users. And Apple's talked about, or I think Steve Jobs talked about, cars and trucks, right? You have a lot more cars on the road. You can think of that as sort of the iOS ecosystem. And then you have trucks, which, you know, get a lot of work done and we still need, but there's just fewer of those, right? They're more commercial, more utilitarian. So those are the people who are going to be creating content and creating applications and doing, you know, web development work, building all the infrastructure that is going to go into supporting the larger volume of users, which are the consumers who are going to be using iOS devices. And I think that makes sense to me. I can see that moving forward. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there sort of saying, oh, iOS is going to take over, everything's going to converge. And that scares a lot of people who really rely on desktop Macs and MacBook Pros and those sorts of things. I don't think you need to be worried if you're in that camp. I think we're all going to be okay. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But certainly Apple is focusing on that larger consumer market, and iOS devices have a lot of appeal over there. Finally, on the iPad Pro, iFixit did do their teardown, and something else very interesting was revealed. It has a Fresco Logic FL1100 4-port USB 3.0 host controller inside of it. So that means it could potentially run at USB 3 speeds, which would up the transfer rates in the iPad Pro from what we see in the current iPad line. And as a matter of fact, Jeff Carlson says that someone told him the Lightning port on the iPad Pro is actually capable of transferring at those USB 3.0 data speeds. The only problem is at this point, we need some kind of new adapter. The current adapters do not run at the faster speed. They're rumored to be in the works, so maybe we'll get one. It'll be cool, especially if it's a multi-port, because it sounds like that thing can support up to 4 ports on that controller. So a 4-port, you know, iPad Pro USB adapter, That could be pretty cool. You could plug in a lot of peripherals. I think it would be great for musicians. People need to plug in MIDI devices. As a matter of fact, Victor Cajiao and I talked about that, I think, a little bit on the last Amigos show. So take a listen to that one in case you missed it. But pretty exciting things surrounding the iPad Pro. Now, this next story, though, gets interesting. You would think that Apple's latest iPad would have the best display that they've ever made. It would be a Pro display, right? Well, the folks over at DisplayMate have tested the latest large glass LCD panel that Apple has on the market. And while they say it is a top tier display, they also say it's not the best display that Apple makes. Which one is their best display? Would it surprise you if I said it was the iPad mini? Well, it is. The iPad Pro missed in just a couple categories when put up against the iPad mini, which, according to DisplayMate, they said was a near perfect display. Where did the iPad Pro fall short? Well, in color accuracy, it was very good, but they noted some small color errors. They also said it had slight irregularities in the logarithmic intensity scale tests. I have no idea what that means, but it was an area where it got dinged a little bit. And even Microsoft's Surface Pro 4 display slightly edged out Apple's iPad Pro. It scored an A in the DisplayMate test to Apple's A-. So we're just a little bit behind the Surface Pro. And remember, these are laboratory tests. These are very, you know, scientific, accurate things. I think most people, when they're picking up an iPad Pro, are not going to have any issues with the display. I think it's gorgeous. I'm not noticing anything wrong with it. But in laboratory, strict scientific testing, it is not as good as a Surface Pro 4 or the iPad mini. So if you want Apple's best mobile tablet display, look at the mini, not the Pro. And the Pro still is a great display, so no one should feel cheated out. It's just DisplayMate says the iPad mini is the best, most accurate display of any LCD tablet they've ever tested. So that's the best one on the market. And if that's what you're going for, that's probably the iPad you should buy. So Apple Pencil, very few of us can get our hands on one. I was lucky enough, I was able to do it. They're slowly trickling into stores. But of course, the minute that iFixit got their hands on one, guess what they did? They completely ripped it apart. And for the people who don't have one yet and are pining for one, that's a little bit painful. It hurts a little bit. But it was worth it because the technology inside of this thing is so cool. So the tip has a little metal nib inside of it, and that's assumed to have the emitters that allow the pencil to detect things like the position and the orientation so that you can do the shading and stuff like that with it. The pressure sensor on it actually features a tiny little board with a series of moving ticks, and they believe that's what helps do the pressure sensitivity when you press down on the tip of the thing. The entire inside, they actually had to slice it open with a Dremel to actually get in there. And when they pulled it out, the entire inside is housed in this giant metal sleeve, metal casing. And they had to rip that open as well. And what they found inside of there was mostly a battery, not a huge battery. It's a lithium ion tube shaped battery, so same shape as the barrel of the pencil. It's rated at 3.82 volts and 0.329 milliwatt hours. So tiny little battery, about 5% the capacity of your iPhone 6S, if you're trying to put that into perspective. So not very large at all, but it still ekes out, you know, a 10 to 12 hour battery life. So they got a lot out of that little thing, probably because they also found inside there, inside that, you know, metal casing, a little folded up logic board. It was actually folded in half so they could cram it into the slender profile of the Apple Pencil. And as a matter of fact, iFixit calls it the smallest logic board that they've ever seen. But just because it's small doesn't mean it's not powerful. It actually has an ARM CPU on there, a smart Bluetooth controller, along with three other chips. So they've packed three chips onto this little folded logic board. And that processor is a STMicroelectronics low power 32-bit ARM Cortex M3 microcontroller. Don't know what clock speed and all it's running at, but just the fact that it's an ARM processor in that tiny little Apple Pencil, that seems really cool to me. I don't know. I get giddy about stuff like that. And then they have a Qualcomm Bluetooth 4.1 chip. It's made by Cambridge Silicon Radio. But I would imagine because it's Bluetooth 4.1, that's why they're able to eke a lot of the power out of it, because it's very low power usage on that. Not surprisingly, in terms of repairability, which is one of the things iFixit rates on all of their all of the things they tear down, the Apple Pencil got a score of 1, which I think is their lowest score. I don't think they have a 0. They probably would have given it a 0, although they did note, you know, you can change the tip, so there are some changeable parts. You could also replace the cap, I guess, if you damaged it. But other than that, you're really, once the pencil's battery wears out or what have you, I don't think you're going to be replacing it. I think you're going to be throwing it out and getting a new pencil for $99. So hopefully by that time, Apple has their Apple Pencil inventory sorted out, and you don't have all the kind of trouble you have getting one as you do right now. But, you know, the Apple Pencil, as you can tell, turns out they pack a lot of engineering complexity into this thing, more than I would have thought. And, you know, maybe that's why they're having some of the issues. As a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo, the analyst, said this week that manufacturing has not been going so smoothly for Apple on the accessories, at least not as smoothly as they had planned. And that makes the scarcity in my mind make a little more sense. I mean, we haven't even seen the smart keyboards outside of the hands of reviewers. So something even bigger must be going on with that, because they're not shipping those yet. And, another thing about the pencil, something a lot of people worried about, the way you charge it, well, there's actually two ways you can charge it. You can take the little cap off, and there's a lightning connector, so that the end that would be what you would assume would be the eraser end of a pencil. You pull this little magnetic cap off, and you just plug the lightning cable right in to your iPad Pro, and that will charge it. Apple says it'll get a 30-minute charge in about 15 seconds. Well, when you do that, you kind of have this long antenna. The pencil's actually a pretty long thing. So a lot of people have worried, you know, what happens if you bump that thing or hit it when it's sticking out of the lightning connector? Well, you know, will the connector snap off? A YouTuber this week tried to actually destroy his Apple Pencil by plugging it into his iPad Pro and just cranking on it left, right, up, down. And while it crunched and you know, kind of cracked around in there, it took a lot for him to actually destroy it. So I think a casual bump, you're going to be fine. I don't think anything's going to happen to it. If you take it and you try and lift up your entire iPad and crank down on it, yeah, you can probably break it. But it turned out to be a lot more robust than I think a lot of people were thinking. I was actually worried when I was watching the video that what was going to happen was he was going to actually break the lightning port on his iPad Pro, which would be an even more expensive repair. I mean, $99 pencil versus, you know, $1,000 iPad Pro. It didn't seem like a smart thing to do, but he did it anyway, so we don't have to do it. So that's a good thing. And then, like I said, Apple Pencils and smart keyboards are still in scarce supply. It's getting better at Apple retail stores. And as a matter of fact, at the end of the week here, Friday, they started showing up in Best Buy stores, at least here in the States. I think they're showing up more and more in the UK and some other countries. I've been getting reports from you from around the globe. If you do have stuff coming into your retail stores, let us know where they're showing up and where you're finding them, so we can share that information so people can find them. I ordered all of my accessories on launch day, and they still have yet to ship. It feels a little bit wrong to me that they're starting to show up in Best Buy before they've even shipped them out to customers who ordered them day one. And I do know from going into my Apple retail stores and talking to some other people that Apple employees have been able to also buy them, and Apple's business teams are also setting some aside for customers, which is why it's a little bit harder to find them in Apple retail stores. I have mixed feelings about Apple employees picking them up, only because they can kind of buy them out of the back of the house before they actually show up on the floor. I think early on, that was probably why a lot of stores weren't getting them. One, they weren't getting a lot of inventory. I had heard they were only getting one or two a day or every other day, something like that. So they were going pretty quickly. Now they're showing up now. You have a better chance if you want to get into an Apple retail store. But again, keyboards nowhere to be found. I haven't seen them. If you do spot one, let us know about it, and we'll try and alert everybody either on Twitter or through the social media or on the next episode of the MacCast. But hopefully by the next MacCast, I'll have my Apple keyboard and I'll be able to give you a little review. Later on, I'm going to give you my review and thoughts on the Apple Pencil. Apple also has responded to an iPad Pro charging issue that's being reported online. They actually issued a statement saying that they're investigating this problem where some people will charge their iPad Pro and when they remove it from charging, it doesn't wake up. Nothing happens. It's unresponsive. And what you actually have to do is force restart the iPad by holding down the sleep wake button and the home button. Apple says for right now, that is the temporary fix. Hold that down for about 10 seconds until you see the Apple logo on screen and it should boot back up. I read that some people have reported similar issues with iPhone 6s and 6s Plus models, specifically ones running iOS 9.1. So there's been some speculation that maybe there's a bug in the latest version of the operating system. But Apple has, you know, responded to the iPad Pro issue saying they are working on it. So hopefully there'll be a fix sometime soon. For me personally, I haven't had any issues with charging my iPad Pro and having it wake from sleep. But in case you've run across it, that's how you can deal with it. Apple had another little oops this past week where if you went to launch an App Store app, in some cases, you were told that the app was damaged and that you needed to delete and re-download the app. If you saw this message or if you see this message, just know that you are not alone. Apple was updating, apparently, their App Store signing certificates. They were bringing them up to date to include stronger industry-recommended encryption. They were moving from something called SHA-1 to SHA-2, and they were in the process of replacing these older signing certificates that developers use on the App Store. And so it was a totally planned update, but apparently what wasn't planned for was that the Apple Store actually cached some of the old stuff. So there was this mismatch that caused many of us to see this error. I saw it on a few applications, and it also made it so you couldn't launch the app, which was a little bit frustrating. The quick fix is to actually simply reboot your Mac, or you could delete, re-download the app. Either one of those things, I guess, will clear the cache. And Apple is planning to fully address the issue with a future software update. Now, one other thing that happened, and I don't know if this is related or not related, but I just want to throw it out there in case somebody else runs across this issue. I saw the message for a non-Mac App Store app, and I tried re-downloading the app from the developer's website. That didn't work either. What I ultimately ended up having to do was actually force open the app, bypassing Gatekeeper. And for anybody who doesn't know how to do that, if you ever get an app that's not signed by a developer and you want to run it, again, this is a potential security risk, so know what you're doing. But if you're trying to open it up and you actually want to run it, it will warn you, hey, this thing's not signed. You can simply right-click on the app or control-click on it so you get the menu and then choose open from that. And then it will pop up and say, okay, this isn't signed. Are you sure you want to open this app? And then you say yes, and then the app will open bypassing the Gatekeeper controls. So that's one way to force an app to open that maybe has a bad or invalid certificate. Again, that can be a little bit of a security risk. So just know that you've gotten the app from the developer's actual website, that it is a good known developer. And that was what was going on in this case. It was an app that I've used for years. I think there was just a mismatch with the signing certificate, and maybe that developer had to go back and re-sign the app, something like that. But I did pull a brand new clean version from their website, so I knew or was fairly certain I had a safe, secure app. Hopefully I don't run into any issues, but I just wanted to point that out. And in case any of you have run across a similar issue, let me know about it. I'm curious if this extends farther than just the Apple App Store apps. Consumer Intelligence Research Partners, a research firm, estimates that about 101 million iPhones are in active use just in the U.S. That is an amazing figure. More impressive, though, is they say that two-thirds of those iPhones were purchased in the last 2 years. So that's about 58 million iPhone 6 and 6 Plus models, plus an additional 4 million iPhone 6s, and 6S Plus models, according to the report. And if the new model iPhone numbers seem a little bit low to you right now, that's because the report is actually from back in September, which was not very long after the new models were released. So I would expect that number to be a little bit bigger by this point. But big numbers for Apple, the good news is also translate into even bigger products, because according to the latest numbers from Canaccord Genuity, they say that Apple now has a 94% share of the profits in the smartphone market, and that's up from 92% back in July. Samsung remains the only other company making profits off smartphones, according to Canaccord, with an 11% share. Now, if you're adding the numbers, 94 plus 11, you notice, hey, that's more than 100%. Yeah, it's about 105 split between Apple and Samsung, and that's because all of the other companies making smartphones, according to the report, are actually losing money. So what's even more amazing is that Apple achieved those products by producing just 14.5% of the total smartphones on the market in the last quarter. And that's because Apple's average selling price on an iPhone in the US is about $670. And if you compare that to the average selling price of a Samsung phone, theirs are just about $180 US. So Apple's almost, I don't know what's the math on that, a little more than three times the average selling price of the next competitor that is actually making profits on smartphones. And Apple also thinks the holiday quarter will continue to bring the profit trend upward as more customers reach the end of their contracts and look to upgrade their devices. As a matter of fact, UBS research believes that Apple will sell a record 78.4 million iPhones this holiday season. So things are looking pretty cheerful for Apple moving into their biggest quarter of the year. We've also been getting rumors about next-gen models. We've talked a little bit about it on the MacCast, but this week TrendForce has added that they believe that the iPhone 7 models will add waterproofing to the feature list. And all I have to say is, what has taken so long? I think we've had the ability to make waterproof phones. Some of the Apple's competitors have done it. I'm glad to see, and I really hope that this rumor turns out to be true, that Apple does make a waterproof phone. TrendForce also confirms some of the other earlier rumors we had been hearing about the next generation iPhone, specifically that the Plus model will get a RAM boost from 2 gigabytes of RAM to 3 gigabytes of RAM. And they say that Apple is expected to release the iPhone 7 in the second half of the year. We'd kind of been hearing Apple might bump it up rather than having a fall release. They might have a summer release, moving it back to kind of the older schedule for iPhone updates. I'm hoping that will happen because I liked it when things were spread out a little bit more and we didn't have sort of everything launching in the fall. They also reiterated the rumor that Apple will have an updated 4-inch model iPhone. They say sometime in the second quarter of 2016. New info does suggest that the specs might not be as new, quote unquote, as previously reported. New info this week came in from a post on the Japanese blog Mac Takahara. They claim the replacement for the current iPhone 5S will be a new 4-inch model. It will have an Apple A8 processor, not the newer A9 that had been previously rumored. They say other specs would be 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, Bluetooth 4.1, a FaceTime HD camera, and a f2.2 aperture rear camera. The 4-inch model, the updated 4-inch model, is not expected to have 3D touch, but it should have Touch ID. And they also don't dispute the claim made earlier by analyst Ming-Chi Kuo that the new phone would have a all-metal design. So updated all-metal design iPhone in a 4-inch form factor. And I know from hearing from a number of you that there is a market for that. There's a lot of people that really like that 4-inch form factor. They'd like an updated model. This is feeling like it's mostly going to be an iPhone 5S with an updated case, but pretty much the internal specs and everything else remaining the same, and it would come in at that low end price point of the iPhone Matrix. So it'd fill out that line where the iPhone 5S currently sits. And I think it makes a lot of sense because mentally, people going into a store, they want to be buying the newest, latest, and greatest iPhone. They don't really want last year's model. So this is kind of what Apple did with the iPhone 5C. And I know there was a lot of dispute over that model, but I've seen a lot of them out in the wild, and I think it was a pretty popular phone for Apple. So I think it makes sense for them to do this, and I do believe that we might see a new updated 4-inch model sometime in the first quarter of 2016. It really wouldn't surprise me. Also, good news for Apple on the Apple Watch front. Apple Watch and actually some other watches seem to be making a dent in Swiss watch sales. Johnny Ive said it was going to happen. The Swiss said, no way are, you know, smartwatches going to dent our business. Well, this week we heard from the Swiss Customs Office. They released a statement showing that exports of Swiss watches have dropped 12% in October. And it's not conclusive that the rise of smartwatches are the cause, but the timing seems incredibly likely to me. In fact, they say the biggest decline in watch shipments was in Hong Kong, where smartwatches have typically done, or where smartwatches have done well, and it's typically a good market for high-end watches like Swiss watches. They say they saw a bigger drop in October of 39% in that area. And so something is going on there. And Apple certainly is benefiting from that. Looks like they're going to be ramping up and shipping more watches. DigiTimes says their supply chain checks indicate that Apple might ship 10 million Apple Watches by the end of this year. Even more interestingly, though, they say Apple might be looking for another supplier to help them make Apple Watches, possibly indicating that Quanta, the company that's currently producing watches for Apple, is maxed out in keeping up with demand. Apple is supposedly considering Inventec, Winstron, and Foxconn Electronics, but all of those companies are reportedly hesitant of partnering up with Apple because despite making a ton of watches for Apple, Quanta did not have a great past quarter. And that may be because Apple is notoriously hard on their suppliers, always eking out the best possible deal. So Apple is a shrewd negotiator when it comes to dealing with these companies. And so some of their partners get a little bit hesitant of like, do we really want to get into this business with you? Because it's going to make it very hard for us to make a profit. And so Apple looking at, you know, sort of expanding smartwatch business would say to me that things are going pretty well. And Apple has said publicly, while they don't talk about specific numbers, that Apple Watch is doing well, even beating their own expectations. And this would just be further evidence, I think, to show that that really is going on. And then finally, in the Apple Watch news, Apple this week also did release a new Apple Watch stand, their own version of a stand. It is $79 US, so about $80. It's shaped like a flying saucer, has a little charging disc in the middle, lightning cable that plugs into the back, and that little charger disc actually flips up so that it can be used in nightstand mode. It almost looks like this round sort of fluffy pillow, although I think it's hard plastic. I haven't been into the Apple Store to actually see one. They are out now. You can order them, pick them up in the Apple Store. I think it looks gorgeous. Seems a little bit pricey to me, but Apple has always been known for their kind of more pricey accessories. There's a lot of third-party accessories out there, but of course you've got to get your own charging cable to plug into those. What's nice about this is it is another charging cable, which Apple sells, I think, for about $29 US. So if you take that off the price, you're looking at what, you're about $50 in that range. So worth looking into. It is another option. But you know, what's up with Apple's recent obsession with spaceship designs? You know, we've got two spaceship campuses being built, and now they come out with this. I'm wondering, are we going to see a round iMac next? Or, hey, maybe Johnny Ive is planning on bringing back the spaceship-shaped airport base station. Remember those? I don't know. Flying saucers on the brain. Maybe the alien invasion has begun and Apple is going to be our computer overlords. I don't know. It's interesting nonetheless. But a pretty cool new accessory from Apple if you've got the cash for it. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. If you remember, I think a couple weeks ago, we were talking about Apple cables. I had some feedback from a listener who commented that they were having to replace a lot of various cables, lightning cables, headphone cables, even MacBook Pro charging cables. And in the past, we've seen people post images of frayed cables. There's even been some scary things where some cables have caught fire because they're damaged around the connectors. And we can debate back and forth on, you know, is it abuse by the user or is Apple actually have a problem? And I've heard both ways. And the feedback that I've received from you, some people have said, I've never had problems with the Apple cables. Some say I have problems all the time and there's everything else in between. I'm probably kind of an in-between person. I think I mentioned on the show that I've had a couple lightning cables that have seemed stressed around that connector. I've only ever had one that actually frayed to the point where I just had to throw it out and get a new one. But along with the feedback, I got this great comment and tip from Chuck.
Hi, Adam. My name is Chuck Watts. I wanted to respond to your rant about cabling. 2 points. First, I've never had a problem with the cable, the power cable for Mac laptops, etc. Never had them break. Never had the wiring weakness. Frankly, I like the way the two prongs pop out on the block and you wrap it around there. It keeps it from having stress points right at that location. And I use that pretty religiously. But the second point is that if with respect to the iDevices, if you have AppleCare Plus, Apple will replace those headphone wires, which I agree do get screwed up from time to time, and power cords and Thunderbolt cables, lightning adapter cables, all of those do fail at the rate that you described, and I take them in one at a time and have them replaced at the Apple store, and typically they do it without even having to have an appointment or anything. So if you got AppleCare Plus, even on one phone, you can probably get all those wires replaced as needed. That's my suggestion and my thought. Take care. Love the show. Listen all the time.
Hey, thanks, Chuck. I appreciate that. You know, that was something that I was unaware of. I totally agree with you about Apple's laptop cables. I've never had one of those fail on me. And I do like those little flip-out tabs where you wrap them around. And I've never had one of my cables break at that weak point. But I have seen it on other laptops, which is why I mentioned it in the prior episode. And I think one of the reasons is you have to be very careful when using that wrapping because of how the cable comes out of the adapter in the middle there. You got to make sure that you give yourself enough of a little lead before you start wrapping it around those tabs to where it's not being pulled to the left or the right. I've seen people, you know, take it out of there and they just crank down on that as they wrap around those little tabs. And it's really stressed or stretched over because Apple has that little reinforcement that comes out there. Even that part will be bent if people pull it hard enough. So I think some people just aren't taking as much care in that area, and that eventually can lead to some problems. But I don't think that it's necessarily obvious that that's what you need to do either. So if you're just, you know, in a hurry and you pull your thing out and you just start wrapping it, you can get that situation happen. I'm always really careful to make sure that I have a nice long tail on there, loop it a little bit before I start wrapping around to the left or right. But, you know, I totally agree with you. I like that it keeps the cables nice and clean, and I appreciate that feature. I don't want Apple to take it away, but maybe a little more instruction or something to kind of show people how to avoid a problem in that area would be a good thing. But the bigger part of your tip that I didn't know, and I guess I never tried, it would have been worth it to ask, right, is I didn't know that Apple would replace cables for you if you had AppleCare. I just figured that was a user, you know, consumable part, and it wasn't something that Apple would do. And I wonder if it might be on a store-by-store basis or a case-by-case basis when you go in there, but it's certainly worth a shot. And if it's a standard policy, that is awesome. That is great. And I would for sure recommend that to people in the future. So I may ask around with some people I know who work at the Apple store and see if they can confirm that for me or what the actual policy is. But the fact that you've been able to do it and take advantage of that means good things for the rest of us. So I really thank you for letting us know about that. As I mentioned earlier, one thing that I wanted to cover in this episode is some of my thoughts, opinions, and comments on the Apple Pencil. And the reason is I was finally actually able to get my hands on one. It is incredible still to me that Apple did not have this accessory ready to go on launch day, because after using it for just a couple days, I was completely blown away. I mean, it is a really amazing device. It should have been ready at launch, because it really takes, I think, the iPad Pro to another level for a lot of customers. I think both accessories are really critical for sort of defining the device and the space. I told you a little bit earlier how I've got mixed feelings on the keyboard for myself, but I think it's still a critical accessory for a number of users. And the pencil, I think, is in that exact same category. And it's amazing for a number of other reasons, because a lot of people will argue, well, we've had different styluses and things for the iPad for a while. The problem is none of them have ever really, I think, worked the way they should. They're all good. I don't want to say they're not good, because I've owned a number of them. I have the Jot Touch. I have the Pencil by 53. Great styluses and accessories for the current generation iPads. But they've always had little nuances, little things, in my opinion, where they've fallen short. One of those things being palm rejection. Another thing is pressure sensitivity. They're good, but they were never great. They were never perfect. And after using the Pencil, I can say it is near perfect. I'm not going to say it's totally perfect, but it is near perfect on many levels, most specifically with the palm rejection and the pressure sensitivity. And on pressure sensitivity, I saw an interesting comment from Serenity Caldwell, who did a great review over at iMore, in case you missed it. But she noted, you know, Apple doesn't disclose the actual pressure sensitivity levels, but it doesn't matter, because it just expects the way you would expect it to work. You go lightly and it gives you a light line. You go a little bit harder, it gives you a medium line. You go even harder, it gives you a dark line. That's all you really want, right? You want the thing to feel like the physical analog version that it's trying to replace. And I can say without a doubt that the Pencil on the iPad Pro is like that. Almost zero lag. There's no delay from the time you press on the screen to when you're actually seeing a line drawn out in the various applications. I will say where it doesn't quite match the analog is it still feels like writing on glass. It's still, you know, a hard surface on another hard surface. There's a little tick, tick, tick sounds as you're writing, especially things like notes when you're taking text, as the tip of the Pencil, which is hard plastic, taps the glass. So you're not getting that sort of resistance. Early on in some of the early reviews, we saw as Apple was showing it around to places like Pixar and things like that, a couple of them had commented that it felt like maybe Apple added some sort of texture to the screen on the iPad Pro. It's still that high gloss screen, so you do get that same kind of feel. But I tried with several drawing apps, including Paper by 53, Sketchbook Pro, Procreate, and Apple's own built-in notes application, and they all work great. Something that's really cool is the notes application is surprisingly good. So just what's built into the iPad is really great at taking notes and doing drawings. It has great pressure sensitivity. It has great tools. The ruler in the notes app is amazing. So you can pull out a ruler and draw straight lines. Paper by 53 and some of the other applications like Procreate and Sketchbook Pro and the Adobe applications offer more functionality. But you can really get by with just what's in the notes application, both for taking notes and for doing drawings. Paper by 53 is still my favorite, but I think that's because I'm more of a doodler than an actual artist. I think people who are professional artists will probably appreciate more apps like Sketchbook Pro, Procreate, or even the Adobe apps. I have to say, the Adobe apps with a Creative Cloud subscription are brilliant, because they don't try to be Photoshop on the iPad, or they don't try to be Illustrator on the iPad. they're supplemental applications. So you have things like Sketch, which allows you to just do simple drawings, and then you can do that, bring those into Photoshop or Illustrator later to kind of finish them up. It's more of that hybrid workflow that we talked about a little bit earlier. You have an app like Fix, which allows you to simply retouch some of your photos on your iPad and then bring them into something like Photoshop to finish them off, or Mix, which allows you to do masking and compositing. Or if you're a web developer like myself, you're going to use a tool like Comp to quickly sketch out layouts for ideas and designs that you're working on, and then probably bring them into Photoshop so you can more flesh them out, make them into truly sort of comps and layouts that you might show a client. But if you're just out and about and you're just trying to sketch out some quick elements, it works really great for that. And with the pencil, you can just draw a box, right? And then you've got an image area, or you draw out a menu or what have you. And it works really, really well. And you sync all that through the cloud, and then you can bring everything into your Mac. It is a really kind of new paradigm, a new way to work, and a different kind of workflow, but I think it works very well with the iPad Pro. One disappointment that I wasn't able to kind of test out was the Microsoft Office documents, things that they showed off during the WWDC keynote. They had the ability to take a Word document and mark it up. So say you were a proofreader and you wanted to put in all kinds of proofreading marks on a Word document, you could be able to do that. Those tools are not out. Those updates are not out, up, and available yet. Apparently, I'm not a OneNote user, but OneNote has been updated to support the pencil, and I've read reports that that works very well. I do need to try out, I think, more note-taking applications, but I did try Notability for taking notes, and it pretty much is as close to mimicking pen on paper or pencil on paper that I think you're going to be able to get with a device like an iPad or a tablet. So I would see no problems with anybody who wanted to actually use this to replace a notebook. I think we finally have a device that can be a true digital alternative to paper notebooks and sketchbooks with the iPad Pro. If that's something that you're interested in, I think definitely the iPad Pro plus the pencil are worth looking at. With that said, I'm going to say it will never replace paper and traditional tools. But I think it can be another tool in your arsenal and something that you may always have with you. One of the disadvantages, I think, of using paper notebooks, because I've used them for years, right, is you have to have them with you and you sort of fill them up and then you put them on a shelf and you kind of forget about those things. With digital, you can kind of keep everything with you. You can store stuff in the cloud. You can have all your ideas right there. You don't have to sort of make that compromise. You can only really carry around maybe a handful of physical paper notebooks with you. With a digital device, right, you have the one device and you can just have it all with you all of the time. And that's the promise of that. Where it's always fallen short is at replicating that experience of actually sketching something out in a notebook. And I think with the pencil, we're really there. And if you're not convinced, I would encourage you to head to an Apple retail store and just try one out for yourself. I think you're going to be really blown away. And if you read the reviews, you can probably hear that my sentiment is not alone. I mean, it's amazing. I've shown it to other people. I've been at places where I'm using the iPad Pro with the pencil and someone will notice me and I've simply handed it over to them. And a lot of times they're artists or photographers or people who work in creative fields and they try it out and they're immediately blown away. I mean, I would venture to guess that they're going to leave right then and there, head to an Apple store and try and pick one of these things up. Unfortunately, again, the pencil's still trickling out there. But once you get your hands on one, I think you're never gonna want to give it up. It's just really cool, and it's just really, again, frustrating and baffling to me that Apple did not have these things ready to go on day one. Because I really do think it takes the iPad Pro to a whole nother level. It is really the thing that sets it apart from something, say, like an iPad Air, which is a great device. And I love my iPad Air, but, you know, this is on a whole different plane when you start adding in these accessories. So far, totally blown away. I really don't have much negative to say about it. I guess the only thing that was frustrating is it doesn't come with any kind of holder or any kind of way to attach it to your iPad. I worry about losing it a little bit, but there's some third-party solutions coming out for that. You know, you can get some straps or different kinds of things. I even supported a Kickstarter project that is a little holder that docks into the Lightning connector and allows you to carry the pencil along with the iPad Pro. But just totally blown away. I would say it is a must-have accessory for anybody who has a desire to do sketching or note-taking with their iPad Pro. So really consider it and take a look at it at the Apple Store if you've been thinking about it. Here is a cool little tip for anyone who has a new Apple TV with the Siri remote. If you have that, you've probably experienced the situation by now. You go to pick up the remote, you're watching a movie or a TV show, and you accidentally somehow brush the trackpad. Actually, it's not that hard to do. Picking the thing up, you might have it flipped around the wrong way, or you're just going to reach for a button. You accidentally hit that trackpad, and what happens is immediately you get the pop-up with the little preview, and the scrubber thumbnail comes up as if you're trying to scrub through a film. Your film pauses, and you're kind of stuck there. And you know that if you click the trackpad, if you press on it at all, it's going to jump to that point. You're going to totally lose your position in whatever the thing that you were watching. And of course, you could try to scrub backwards or forwards to find the exact spot you were just at, but that can be really tricky. Luckily, our friend Sebastian Page over at iDownload blog has a reader who was experiencing the same issue and discovered a really good trick. If the scrubber comes up and you haven't clicked yet, so you haven't jumped to the new position yet, and you just want to get back to where you were, if you simply hit the menu key, it will undo that accidental scrub and return you to the spot that you were just at. It's like canceling the scrubber button out completely. Easy and simple, but only if you actually know the trick, right? I didn't know about this till I read about it. So I wanted to share that with you. The other thing I wanted to share with you is if you're looking for more information on how to use the Apple TV, you want to find some of these cool little hints and tricks and hidden controls and stuff like that, I would recommend checking out Apple's Apple TV user guide. And if you don't know where that is, I don't blame you, because Apple doesn't really advertise this. And actually, this goes for all of their manuals and user guides. They're all available on the iBook store. So I'll have links in the show notes at maccast.com. But if you just search for Apple Inc. in the iBook store, you will find all of the Apple books, including all of the Apple manuals online. And you can just download them, put them into iBooks, and read them at your leisure. And you can discover a lot of cool little things that most people don't know if you read through the manual. I know manuals can tend to be boring. Apple does a pretty good job of trying to filter things down and not make manuals too overwhelming or too long. And they're definitely worth reading through if you really want to get to know your Apple products. So check that out, the Apple TV user guide. So this is something interesting that I received in an email from Carlos in Argentina. And something I think we all struggle with is storage, right? It seems like no matter how much storage you have on your Mac or on your iOS device, you eventually start to run out. And Carlos was in this kind of situation. He has an internal flash drive on his Mac, 500 gigabytes, which is ample storage space. But he was finding that it was mysteriously filling up. And this was despite doing the things that a lot of us do, which is, you know, move your photo library and your music library off your main drive, put them on an external, because those things fill up, especially music and photos. So he was like, okay, I'm running out of space. I've got a 500 gig drive. I've only got like 40 gigabytes free. What's going on here? Well, he used a tool, which is actually a really great tool from our friends at the Omni Group, Omni Disk Sweeper, to check for large files. And what's awesome about Omni Disk Sweeper is it's totally free. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's part of Omni's other applications. If you listen to the show, you know I'm a big fan. I use Omni Outliner, Omni Focus, Omni Graffle. I mean, everything Omni makes is worth buying. I'll just tell you that right now. But Omni Disk Sweeper, totally free. And what it does is it scans your hard drive and it looks for large folders and files that can show you those things. And then you can kind of determine, hey, is this stuff I want to keep on my system, or can I archive this off and maybe gain some disk space back? Another tool in the same category that I really like is DaisyDisk. DaisyDisk is about $10 US. does a similar kind of thing. It gives you this visual layout and shows you where the big chunks of data being used up on your hard drive are, and then you can analyze that and decide what to put away. So Carlos ran this on his Mac, and what he found was that his home library folder, so if you go into your home folder, you go to the library folder, he discovered that that was using over 300 gigabytes of his hard disk space. And most of that, about 273 gigabytes, was inside the caches folder. More specifically, in a folder called com.apple.bird. And I'm going to get to that bird thing in a minute because I found that very interesting. But before we get to that, I want to have a general conversation about the caches folder that's in your library folder. So there's also actually a caches folder at the root of your system drive and at the root library folder. But specifically the one that's in your home directory in home library caches, in general, anything in that inside that folder, and I'm making a blanket statement here, so just bear with me, but anything inside that caches folder is more or less safe to just delete. So if you notice things in there and it's taking, they're taking up a large amount of space, you can probably just delete them without much consequence. And you notice I'm being a little bit hesitant about this. And the reason is the reason you can delete them rather is that the cache files are created by various applications or things inside the operating system. And most of these apps, if you delete the cache files, they're going to simply just recreate them. Now, before you delete anything in there, though, I think it's still a good idea to maybe back up those files or sort of move them out of the way temporarily, delete them, make sure everything that's is working fine with your system, that it caused no issues, and then actually remove the files. You probably don't want to just willy-nilly remove them right away, just in case. But in general, you should be pretty safe to delete files inside the caches folder. It's also generally recommended that if you're going to go in and delete files in there, that you delete the files themselves. So when you go in the caches folder, you'll notice everything's kind of sorted into its own folder as well. And then within those folders are a lot of the cache files. And they're usually divided up by application or, you know, things like com.apple.itunes, or you'll see the different sort of folders in there. Go inside each individual folder and delete the files themselves. Leave the folders in place. Once again, most of those folders would just get recreated by their applications, even if you deleted them, but it's just a general good recommendation. Okay, so now, what the heck, or why the heck, is there a com.apple.bird folder? When Carlos emailed me, I thought exactly that thing. I'm like, really? com.apple.bird? What the heck is bird? I've never heard of that application. It's a very odd name. What's going on there? I did some digging around. I really wasn't able to find out why the folder is named the way it is, but it does seem like it's mostly used by iCloud in some sort of capacity. It is a vague folder. And if there's someone who works at Apple or has insight into this directory and knows exactly what it is, please email me. But I wasn't able to find anything, at least not very quickly, doing a little bit of Googling. Other than it is related to iCloud and related to app storage or application backups. And the most common reason that I found for the size of this folder, this cache folder, growing out of control seems to be possibly a bug or maybe a feature related to the application called WhatsApp, which I believe I've never used it myself. I think it's kind of a chat application or a messaging application. But apparently it has a feature inside of it where it allows you to do an app backup. And for whatever reason, those backup files over time can build up and get very large. Carlos, I have to give you an award. Yours sounds to be about the biggest one that I read about, at least online. There were a lot of people in forums talking about 50 gigabytes, 60 gigabytes, maybe 75, 100 gigabytes. But the fact that yours is 273 gigabytes, I think you might win some sort of prize or something like that. But the good news is that you're probably pretty safe to be able to just go in there and delete the contents of that entire folder. So go into the, you know, home, library, caches, com.apple.bird folder. Just select everything in there and throw it in your trash. Again, I would advise that maybe you back it up first. just in case something goes wrong, you can put it all back in place and pretend like nothing happened. But you should be able to just delete it. Now, the only thing about deleting that stuff is, as I mentioned earlier, the app might start again building up data in that caches folder. And there may be other apps that are actually using the com.apple.bird folder. I don't know. I would say after you delete it, keep an eye on it. The other thing is, after you delete it, you might consider, if you're using the WhatsApp app, that you go in and turn off its application backup feature. Now, I'm not a WhatsApp user, so I don't know if that's a critical thing, if it's something you really need or don't need, but the advice online was just to turn it off, and then you won't have that folder build back up again. And some people might be saying, well, WhatsApp is an iOS app. I think it's an iOS app. I don't know if they have a Mac client or not. I don't think that they do, but I've been told that it will build up data in there even if you're just using the iOS client. And again, I think that's because it's tied into iCloud. So I think the backups go into your iCloud account, the iCloud stuff syncs to this folder, and then you start losing your Mac hard disk space. So I would give that a shot, see if that doesn't help you sort of clean things out, Carlos. And thanks for sending in your email and asking the question, because I had no idea about this folder whatsoever. And I guess while we're on the topic of sort of cleaning out stuff related to, I guess this was just the Mac, but, you know, iPhones also have this problem, right? You can build up a lot of gunk and junk inside your iOS devices. And many of us, if you've owned an iOS device for any period of time whatsoever, you've likely gotten to the point where you're trying to install something, you're trying to do something, and you get that message, right? Your iPhone is running out of space. Go into settings, clear out your stuff. How do you do that, though? And how do you know what to clear out? Well, this week I ran across a great article by Christian Zyberg over at iDownload blog, and he kind of outlaid this, did an outline for this stuff. So I thought I'd share some of those tips with you. I'll have a link to his full piece in the show notes at macOS.com if you want to read it. But the good advice was, one, guess what? Check your app caches. Yeah, cache seems to be a good place where a lot of old files build up. How do you do that, though? Or how do you know what's in your app caches or how much is in there? Because on iOS, we don't have cool tools like OmniDisk Sweeper or Daisy Disk. What you can do is you can connect your iOS device to your Mac using the Lightning cable and then go into iTunes, select the device, and look at the storage. And there's this category we've talked about in the past called other, right? A lot of the stuff that's in the other category is stuff that's stored in different application caches. What is that stuff? Oftentimes it is offline data for apps like Pocket or RSS readers, or maybe your podcast applications. It's all the things that when you open up that app and it pulls down data from the web and stores it for the application, a lot of that stuff gets stored into that other category, into the app caches. Now, how do you get that stuff out of there? You know, how do you get it purged and get rid of it? Sometimes it's supposed to work where if you need more storage and there's stuff in cache, cache is supposed to get cleared out automatically by the operating system, and that stuff's supposed to push out, and you're supposed to have that storage available for actual storage. Doesn't seem to always work that way. It's not auto magical like Apple would want you to think it was. One way you can kind of clear some of that stuff out is simply doing a restart of your device. Hold down the sleep wake button, home buttons for about 10 seconds till you see the Apple logo. Let it boot back up. Go back in. Look, you'll sometimes see that you've cleared out some of the storage. For me, I've tried that. It works okay. You might get a little bit of space. Doesn't work great all the time. So another way you can do it is a little more manually. You can clear it through the settings in usage. So what you can do is go into settings, general, tap on storage and iCloud usage, then tap on manage storage. And then you can tap on, you'll see a bunch of list of all your individual apps. You can tap on an app to see its information. And when you're looking at its info, if you have the ability to kind of clear out its cache stuff, you're going to want to look for items of data or things under an offline storage category. Not every application is going to have this, but some will. A good example, if you want to see what it looks like, is take a look at Safari. It has offline reading list data. And what you can do when you see that or see anything that's like offline storage is simply swipe your finger across that line item and it should show you a delete option. And then you can simply tap delete, confirm, and you can delete that information. Music and podcasts are another app to check. They have this kind of offline data storage as well. Now, keep in mind, if you do this, you're going to have to re-download the data if you want it back. You're going to have to reconnect to the internet and you're going to have to re-download it. And the whole point of this stuff is it's like offline data, right? So you don't have to be connected to the internet. You probably want to avoid the option when you're looking in here of deleting the app and all of the data. There's an option that'll say delete app and data. That does exactly what it says it will do, which is remove your app and remove all of the data, and you can reinstall the app. Now, sometimes that may be the option that you want to take, right? And it's a more extreme option. If you delete an app, all of the data gets deleted out with it. That includes all of the cache files and the cached data, and that can allow you to free up some extra storage space. If you're going to go that route, I would advise you to make sure that you have your application data backed up someplace else, either pull it in through iTunes, or if it's an app that stores its data up in the cloud and that data can be re-downloaded, then you're probably safe to delete it. But there's been many times where people have deleted applications not realizing that they're actually going to lose all their data. And if you're using, say, like a drawing app and it's only stored on your device, that might not be stuff that you want to lose. So be cautious with that. Another area to check for like cache files is sometimes individual apps inside their own settings will have a way to manage your cache files. So for example, Tweetbot has this option if you go into your account's setting. Its offline data can be purged from within the app itself. So you might check the settings area of an individual app to see if you can't clear that information out. So those are caches, and that's mostly what's covered in the article over at iDownload blog. Now, something that's not mentioned in that article, but is another area to check to clean out storage space, is the Messages app. So when you're using Messages or iMessage, anytime you get a photo or a video, any kind of MMS file, that information is stored within the messaging app. And it can take up and build up over time. If you keep a lot of your messaging history, it can build up a lot of files in there, and it could be eating up a lot of storage space. So if you want to clear that stuff out, open up the Messages app, select a thread that you've been receiving that kind of data in, and then tap on the Details button. And then from there, you'll be able to see all of the attachments within that message thread all in one place. And if you tap and hold on an image or video, you'll get an options dialog. And if you tap on More in that pop-up, you can check off any images that you want, and you can simply tap the trash icon to delete those. Before you do that, though, you may want to look after checking them off and tap on the save icon or the save option. There's a save image option. Save any images that you want to keep out to your camera roll, and then go back in, repeat the process and repeat the steps, selecting all of the attachments and then trashing them. And then you have to confirm that you want to delete them, and it will delete those things permanently, but poof, just like that, you're going to have more storage space. If you want to delete an entire thread, you could, of course, do that. Just know that when you do that, it's going to delete all of its data and attachments. And the way you do that is you go into the Messages app, you find the thread, you swipe across it with your finger, you'll see the delete option. I think you can also tap the edit button and select individual threads that you want to delete and trash them. But once you've deleted them, that is going to clear out any of the attached files, images, video files, all that stuff. And that can free up a lot of storage space. I can't tell you how many people I've seen, their Messages app will be taking up several gigabytes, if not tens of gigabytes of data on their device. So a couple quick ways to gain some storage, both in iOS and in Mac OS X. Last thing that I have for you today is a cool little tip, I guess it's a tip coupled with a question maybe to the community about How can we possibly do something that I couldn't find a way to do? And what this all relates to is Sarah wrote me to ask a question on something that actually has bugged me as well. So that's probably another reason why I am throwing this question out to you. But I've never really went looking for a solution until now. And that is, when using a remote access application on your Mac, something like VNC or maybe even Apple's own screen sharing option, it's often convenient when you're remote controlling a Mac to, or even a PC, I guess, to enter full screen mode, so that in your remote control application, it now feels like you're just simply working on that remote machine, right? You've got the remote machine's menu bar up at the top, maybe the dock at the bottom, and it just looks like you're working on a desktop. Until, it works really great until you overshoot the remote machine's menu bar and you get to the top of your Mac screen and the local menu bar drops down, right? You see the local menu bar, and then everything on the remote screen kind of scales down. It gets weird and it gets really annoying. It sort of breaks you out of that moment, that sort of mirage that that remote machine is actually your local machine, and you're jarred out of it, and you're like, oh, well, that stinks. And so the question from Sarah was, is there a way to always hide the local menu bar when you're in full screen mode and then maybe only activate it with a modifier key? That seems to make sense to me. That would be actually a very convenient thing, Sarah. The only problem is that the answer that I found is no, there's no way to actually do that in Mac OS X. Now, in my research, it looks like there used to be a plist hack that you could do on an app-by-app basis to basically disable the menu bar and the dock within that one application, but that no longer seems to work, at least in OS X El Capitan and a lot of the more recent releases of OS X. I also couldn't find any third-party utilities that would allow you to do it, although there used to be some of those as well, but they mostly, I think, relied on this plist hack, which no longer exists. So it no longer seems to be possible, at least as far as I can tell. And here's where I throw it out to you in the MacCast community. Is there any way to do this? Specifically in OS X El Capitan, using a remote app access application in full screen mode. So I think it's pretty clear what we're looking for there. But as often happens when I'm looking into these things for people, there is a side benefit, because I did discover a cool OS X El Capitan tip that I didn't know before. And that tip is that you can choose to have your menu bar in OS X El Capitan auto hide even when you're not in a full screen application. So I'm familiar with how this works in a full screen app, right? You go full screen, the menu bar at the top automatically hides. When you get your cursor near the top of the window in full screen mode, boom, the menu bars and the toolbars slide down and you can see them. What if you want to have that same effect but not in full screen mode? You can accomplish that with OS X El Capitan. It gives you a cleaner look for your desktop, and it's pretty easy to turn on if you want to use it. You just go into System Preferences, go into the General System Preferences, and there is a little checkbox for automatically hide and show the menu bar. If you check that on, your menu bar will disappear, it will slide out of the way, and when you get your cursor near the top of the screen, it will slide back out just like the auto hiding dock if that's something you use. So I thought that was a cool little tip. And Sarah, thank you for sending me down on this quest to find an answer to your question, because otherwise I wouldn't have found this cool little tip. So I'm going to share that with the MacTech community. And in return, if you can tell Sarah and I if there's any way to manually hide the local menu bar in full screen mode, that would be really cool. All right. So that's your, I guess that's your mission until next week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, Also, Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com/maccast. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. Love getting feedback from you, comments, questions. If you have something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or if you just want to make a comment, you can send your audio comments and emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you want to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Instagram, what have you. I'm all over those places. MacCast, most places. On Twitter, it's twitter.com/MacCast. On Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you want the Google+ community, it's google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. With that, that is going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.